All of this is backed up by a very strong and resolute military option, but be clear, we seek a peaceful solution to this.
North Korea will top the UN General Assembly agenda. It's Tuesday, September 19th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Join us too on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, Australia's detained asylum seekers in limbo. Muslim immigrants helping hurricane relief efforts. We speak with a U.S. member of Congress on Cambodia. DNA guide to your health, building American guitars. It's all on today's VOA Asia. As a candidate for president, Donald Trump belittled the United Nations, claiming it was, quote, not a friend of democracy, freedom, or even to the United States of America. Now as president, he has said the United Nations has tremendous potential and praised the Security Council's recent votes to stiffen sanctions against North Korea for its nuclear bomb tests and missile launches. Ahead of President Trump's first address to the UN General Assembly later today, U.S. UN Ambassador Nikki Haley said the Security Council has pretty much exhausted all it can do to rein in North Korea's missile and nuclear programs. Haley warned Pyongyang will be destroyed if it keeps on with its reckless behavior, and the United States has to defend itself and its allies in any way. Appearing on the CBS program Face the Nation, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said U.S. policy is to deny North Korea a nuclear weapon and the capability of delivering that weapon.
Our strategy has been to undertake this peaceful pressure campaign, we call it, enabled by the four no's being that we do not seek regime change, we do not seek a regime collapse, we do not seek an accelerated reunification of the peninsula, and we do not seek a reason to send our forces north of the demilitarized zone. So the peaceful pressure campaign is built around putting together the largest and strongest international coalition we can to send the same message to North Korea and to North Korea's neighbors, China and Russia, that this is the policy of the rest of the world. And you've seen that expressed now in two unanimous Security Council resolutions to impose the strictest sanctions ever. All of that designed to bring North Korea to the table for constructive, productive dialogue. If our diplomatic efforts fail, though, our military option will be the only one left. So all of this is backed up by a very strong and resolute military option. But be clear, we seek a peaceful solution to this.
Tillerson said China and Russia have a big role to play in cutting two revenue streams that fund the North's weapons programs and economic activity. Those are energy and foreign workers. He said China is North Korea's main supplier of oil, while Russia hosts some 30,000 North Korean guest workers. He said Washington is still waiting for a positive North Korea response for productive, constructive talks. Tufts University Korea expert Sung-Yoon Lee tells VOA's Victor Beatty while he expects further North Korean testing, he does not believe a military showdown is imminent.
Technically, at the UN, there's not all that much that the Security Council can do. We know we expect more nuclear tests and missile tests, and the Security Council will respond, as it has over the past decades, with tougher sanctions measures on paper. But, you know, the crux of the problem always is enforcement. If the member states don't enforce these sanctions, the toughest sanctions on paper have little meaning. So I don't think we should interpret Ambassador Haley's comments as any sign that the U.S. is seriously considering military strike anytime soon. There's been no ultimatum, no deadline set for North Korea's behavior.
Yet she said she's prepared to hand the matter over to Defense Secretary Jim Mattis.
Well, sure, but in fact, you know, the U.S. security, protecting the lives of tens of millions of Americans, that is not on the line yet. Military response will come when that becomes a looming question, when there is clear and imminent danger of a North Korean nuclear strike. Then the military option becomes more than an option. It becomes an imperative. Ambassador Haley's comment reflects her own frustration and the frustration on the part of the U.S. government that, you know, North Korea has been on this bluster barrage all throughout this year, and now with the UN General Assembly meetings to begin this week, I think Ambassador Haley is trying to send signals to Beijing, to Moscow, and other countries to get them on board to enforce sanctions.
White House National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster on Sunday said this regime, referring to North Korea, is so close now to threatening the U.S. and others with a nuclear weapon that we really have to move with a great sense of urgency on sanctions, on diplomacy, and preparing, if necessary, a military option.
Well, that's true, of course, and for far too long, as the administration repeats, the U.S. has, all predecessor administrations have kicked the can down the road. They've procrastinated, taken half measures, and so on. At the same time, I would not really read too much into these harsh-sounding comments. On one hand, there is the utility of sending a strong message, yes, to the adversaries of the United States. At the same time, if you talk it up too much, then the U.S. comes across as the party that's motivated by aggression, which is not very good in terms of world public opinion.
Sung-Yoon Lee said President Trump, in his United Nations speech, will likely urge universal enforcement of existing Security Council sanctions against North Korea. But he also called on the president to use the forum to, for the first time, condemn North Korea's human rights record, including its prison camp network. He said Mr. Trump should call for the freedom of all political prisoners and demand all North Koreans be assured basic human liberties. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on VOAnews.com. U.S. and allied warplanes stage live fire exercise over Korean Peninsula. Despite North Korea sanctions, South Korea plans to send aid. India seeks deportation of Rohingya for security reasons. Indonesia's only transgender Islamic school quietly running again. Blasphemy, a life and death issue in Pakistan. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more are on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also, we invite you to stop by the voanews.com website. We continue with VOA Asia. Australia plans to build another detention center for failed asylum seekers in Papua New Guinea. An existing facility on Manus Island in PNG is due to close within weeks and was found to be unconstitutional by a court last year. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports the decision has left many detainees in limbo.
Australia has detained asylum seekers who try to reach its shores by boat on camps in the South Pacific. About 800 men have been held at a migrant processing facility at Manus Island in Papua New Guinea. Around 600 detainees have had their refugee claims approved and could be resettled in the United States under a deal struck between Canberra and Washington last year. The fate, however, of 200 men at the so-called Regional Processing Centre on Manus Island, who've had their asylum applications rejected, is unclear. About half of this group is expected to be voluntarily deported, but others can't be repatriated because their countries of citizenship will not accept their forced return. Australian Immigration Minister Peter Dutton says these men are likely to be sent to another detention camp on the outskirts of the PNG capital, Port Moresby.
Those people, which total about 200 that have been found not to be refugees, to be moved into an alternative place of detention away from the Regional Processing Centre, given they have no lawful claim to be in PNG.
Australia detains all asylum seekers until security and health checks are carried out. Migrants who arrive by sea have been taken to the Australian-sponsored camps in PNG and on the tiny Republic of Nauru, which will remain open. Officials have said the policy has deterred asylum seekers from risking their lives at sea trying to reach Australian territory. Rights campaigners, however, have consistently criticised conditions inside the camps, which have been beset by unrest, hunger strikes and allegations of the abuse of child detainees. Inmates at Manus Island have also alleged they've been held in torture-like conditions. Australia grants visas to about 16,000 refugees each year. It has also offered protection to 12,000 people fleeing conflict in Syria and Iraq. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Happening now in Asia, a suicide blast near one of Pakistan's two main border crossings with Afghanistan has wounded at least 22 people, including several members of the security forces. Officials said personnel of the paramilitary Frontier Corps were heading to the border crossing when a suicide bomber ambushed their vehicle. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're always happy when you're able to join us on VOA Asia. When Hurricane Irma hit the Florida coast, the Islamic Circle of North America arranged shelter, and after it passed, they provided relief. VOA's Ramon Taylor reports its volunteers, made up of immigrant and non-immigrant, Muslim and non-Muslims, has opened minds and hearts wherever they go to share their shared desire to give back to the community.
When Abdul Rauf Khan's U.S.-born son became a teenager, he asked his father, a Pakistani immigrant, "What have you done for this country?" It has stuck with him ever since.
For myself, I want to make sure I have a legacy for my own children, you know, coming up behind me. They want to take this country as a blessing and say, this country has given us a lot. We have to give back to the country and make sure we can secure that. And this is, should be our proud being Muslim living in America.
Khan has made a living of going where natural disasters strike, whether Hurricane Harvey in Texas or Irma in his home state of Florida. Over the years, he says that providing direct relief and opening the doors of mosques in times of need has opened minds about what it means to be Muslim.
They felt like this is what, like we felt when we go to church, when we go to synagogue.
During and after Hurricane Irma, volunteers from the Islamic Circle of North America traveled from one affected area to another, removing limbs from fallen trees and helping to make affected locals' lives a bit easier. Aksachima says her faith and a desire to constantly give back are closely linked.
Maybe if I help one person and someone sees me helping that person, they'll be like, hey, you know what? It felt nice to bring a smile on that person's face. I can help them too.
It's that compassion that unites Muslim and non-Muslim volunteers.
If it's moving a cup self, but you help and do something. So anything you help, you know in your heart you did something to help another person.
As Florida begins the long process of rebuilding, Khan and his team plan to be there and help their neighbors every step of the way. Ramon Taylor, VOA News, Cooper City, Florida.
You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This news alert from VOA Asia, almost a dozen U.S., Japanese, and South Korean warplanes armed with live weapons flew over the Korean Peninsula in what the U.S. military is describing as a sequenced bilateral show of force in response to North Korea's latest missile launch. The aircraft released live weapons at a training range in South Korea. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories and great features. This is VOA Asia. We continue now with VOA Asia. Last week, VOA's sister network Radio Free Asia closed the doors of its operation in Phnom Penh, Cambodia. The move was made in reaction to what is being called the ongoing pressure and intimidation from the regime of Cambodian Prime Minister Hun Sen. Quite a few members of the U.S. Congress are following the situation in Cambodia, especially Congressman Alan Lowenthal, a Democrat who represents California's 47th district. It's a district that is home to perhaps the largest Cambodian population in the United States. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke with Congressman Lowenthal about the situation.
What we're really concerned about is that there has been an escalation of repressive tactics going on in Cambodia, which leads to us to believe there will not be free and fair elections at all in Cambodia. And some of the things are the making it impossible to operate by Radio Free Asia. And they were the only operation inside of Cambodia that broadcast from inside of Cambodia. So they're not going to be able to do that. And it's also the arrest of the Cambodian National Rescue Party leadership, Mr. Kim Soka, But what is even more concerning to the United States is that the government under Hun Sen has unfounded allegations. You know, Mr. Kim Sok is being charged with treason. And the allegations is that the United States government has collaborated with Kim Sok to destabilize the country.
Is this something new?
This has never occurred before. The United States does not try to destabilize Cambodia. If anything, the United States has been a great supporter of democracy in Cambodia, has been a great supporter of trying to help the Cambodian government move towards democracy, not by picking candidates, not by destabilizing the country, but by promoting democracy in Cambodia. And we've always been known for that, and we've always been known to be fair. And what the United States government has done, and the Congress has been leaders in it, has been saying, Cambodia, you all agreed in 2013 to the what would take place in the elections coming up in 2017 and 18. This was agreed upon by the Cambodian government, and now you're reneging on the deal.
Why all of a sudden?
Why are they reneging? Because of the real chance of a loss of power by the Hun Sen regime is what's happening. We just had local elections. The opposition did quite well, and they did quite well in the previous elections. I think the general feeling is that the government is increasing its attacks because they realize that they could they potentially will lose this election, and after 30 some odd years of power, they're not willing to give up power peacefully.
There are some who are writing, who are broadcasting, who are talking about a stronger relationship with Beijing since this started. Is there any relation or linkage as far as you can see?
Well, we're not now going to say that without more evidence that really is significant behind this, or that this demonstrates a decided shift towards China, or that the Chinese are playing much more of a role in Cambodia that's influencing the government to say that you don't need free and fair elections, you don't need to have a free press, you don't need to have democratic institutions. But there is no doubt, and we're not clear on whether there is any kind of that role. We have not learned about it. But there's no doubt that the Chinese government is investing more and is playing a more active role in Cambodia at this time. And so the issue that you raised is certainly one that we should understand. And it may be potentially what is going on, but I'm not now in a position to say this is all being orchestrated by the Chinese. That I do not know.
What about the U.S. position so far as it now stands with Cambodia?
We're really worried about what is taking place in Cambodia at this time, and it is critical that the administration now begin to address the topic.
Why is Cambodia, and I take it you believe this, geopolitically important?
Well, Cambodia was one of the nations of Southeastern Asia that was moving towards democracy. And there's really going to be, whether it's all of the nations of Southeast Asia, there are very few that really support democratic institutions. Cambodia had been our friend and really had moved in this direction. And plus it has a large diaspora in the United States after the horrors of the killing fields and what took place. Democracy is at risk throughout the world, and especially in Southeastern Asia, and Cambodia is high on that list of losing the precious freedoms that it has.
Congressman Alan Lowenthal of California's 47th District here with us on VOA Asia.
This news alert from VOA Asia, Myanmar's de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi is scheduled to give a highly anticipated national speech a short time from now, addressing her country's crisis in Rakhine State, where ongoing violence has led about 400,000 ethnic Rohingya to flee to neighboring Bangladesh in recent weeks. All the big stories come your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, one of the great things about getting your DNA tested is that you can find out if you have predisposition to all kinds of diseases. VOA's Kevin Enix has found out that new research suggests even if people are armed with genetic information to help them make good health decisions, that doesn't mean that following through will be easy.
Researchers are discovering genetic components to all kinds of bad behaviors. Things like nicotine addiction, alcoholism, even obesity. So you would think that people who learn about their genetic risks for disease would alter their lifestyle. But new research from Cambridge University says that's not really the case.
It's a lot easier to be sedentary. It's a lot easier to eat an unhealthy diet in today's society. So moving those behaviors with just risk information, it probably isn't enough.
One DNA testing company founder agrees.
We need to be able to observe people over time. We need to be flexible about how we change the interventions, and we need to tailor those to people.
But the research also clearly shows some people do change. One Harvard University doctor who advises companies like Helix says change comes usually when the DNA test is the first decision in a commitment towards a more healthy lifestyle.
It depended more on the experience of the testing rather than the message that they were getting from the testing. That's an interesting nuance. It was almost as if just going through the experience of sending away your saliva and getting your DNA information back, the entire experience sort of motivated people. It got them thinking about their health. It got them thinking about risk.
Allie Manzi is a personal trainer who says changing unhealthy behaviors requires constant attention.
They're not looking at the big picture. It's just day to day, like, oh, just this one piece of cake, or I'm just going to skip this one workout. And it's these little pieces at a time, and they're not looking at how their small choices are affecting their overall health and lifestyle.
She agrees that it's just easier to be sedentary, no matter what your DNA test tells you. The study shows that no matter what your DNA says, breaking bad habits, even if you know they can hurt you, is an incredibly hard thing to do. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
Well, by now, you're probably very familiar with President Donald Trump's Make America Great Again slogan as he tries to spur business and bring some manufacturing back to the United States. But sometimes it just doesn't pay to manufacture here. Labor and land tend to be expensive, and it's why most consumer products sold here come from overseas. But a multinational electric guitar manufacturer still produces one-third of its instruments near where it started decades ago. Arash Arabasadi names that tune from Maryland.
Music comes alive on the factory floor of PRS Guitars.
If you sit on the couch with a Magic guitar, you're in no pain. And when you put it away, there's no hangover. That's really good drugs. That's just all flavors are good.
That is Paul Reed Smith, and it is his signature on these guitars. He started by building one instrument per month. Then, with help from family and friends, he launched this company in 1985, and now, at this factory, PRS makes more than 11,000 guitars each year.
This is the American dream come true. This is a whole bunch of people getting together and making something out of nothing.
From start to high gloss finish, it's all made in America.
We are a proprietary company, so if you look at our guitars, the screws are our screws, the strap buttons are our design, the tuning peg is ours, the bridge is patented. All those things are what goes into making a PRS very different than a lot of other guitars.
They also have manufacturing operations in South Korea and Indonesia, and while it's cheaper to build outside the United States, they keep this factory running and its luthiers employed.
The best thing that this company ever did for the world was to provide 250 people jobs and health insurance.
Making these factory workers assembly line artists with a starting pay that's nearly 1.5 times that of the federal minimum wage.
We are musicians. We love to make instruments, and we're fueled, probably, unfortunately, more by the creation of music and the creation of instruments than the creation of money.
But they also create a good amount of money, north of $40 million in 2016. Most PRS guitars cost between $1 and nearly $4,000, with some even more expensive. And they say 2017 will be their best year yet. Music to the ears of the workers in this factory and guitar enthusiasts everywhere. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Stevensville, Maryland.
Made in America Daily with resources from around the world is our program. You've been listening to VOA Asia. We'd like to say a special hello to everyone listening in the Philippines via DZUP 1602 AM radio at the University of the Philippines in Diliman. Thanks for joining us today. Our thanks, too, go to Director Tracy Carter, Engineer Daryl Smith, Managing Editor Diane Gao, Ira Melman, David Byrd, and Ali Ogden on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day.